Welcome to Press X to Science, the podcast where Candy Crush Saga meets B.F. Skinner. On this episode, we'll be focusing on explaining the science behind how mobile games have become one of the world's biggest profit turners. Today, we'll try and give some insight into the research that is uncovering why free-to-play mobile games have been such a hit, and the psychology and physiology of pricing and addiction. But before that, let me introduce our regular co-hosts. First up is astrophysicist, science communicator, and clicker game enthusiast, Tim Young. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Also joining us is science educator and games-based learning advocate, who has also been known to tap at a few screens, Megan Pusey. Hey, Megan.
Hey.
So yeah, today we are talking about mobile games in order to make sure that we have some kind of baseline for talking about this topic. I'll just ask you guys a couple of questions about your mobile gaming habits. Each of you, so how many mobile games have you currently got on your phones?
Well, that's an easy one for me because the answer is zero because my phone blew up the other day.
Oh, no.
Before it blew up then.
Before it blew up, yeah. How many before then?
Oh, it at the time of it, you know, reaching its demise, I would hazard a guess that there would have been just under a dozen.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. How about you, Megan?
Yeah, so I'm sitting at about 13 or 14.
Yeah. Ish. Well, that's similar to me. So, yeah, I've got around about 15 on mine.
I find
how
that,
many...
Yeah, after I've played them to death and I'm not playing them anymore, I just delete and then replace with the new ones.
So. Yeah.
See, I actually thought that 12 was a really high number. I was... Yeah. I thought that was shocking, but apparently not.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call myself a particularly active mobile gamer, and yet here I am.
Me neither.
How many of those would you call freemium, though? Or free-to-play, sorry, I should say. Freemium's a term we'll introduce in a second, but free-to-play games.
Probably say three-quarters of mine are free-to-play or, you know, free-to-install, and the other quarter is paid.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say one or two of them have been paid, but a good number of them have been free with ad support that I've then paid to remove the ads. And I almost consider them to be... a paid game in many respects.
Yeah.
The ads like the demo.
I wouldn't call those free to play necessarily. They're more like ad supported games. They're not quite what we're talking about today. So yeah, I'm similar to you guys, except I think I've probably got more paid ones. I think I've only really got like maybe three or four games that you would consider kind of free to play or freemium. Yeah, so obviously we've all got at least a few games, even though we probably don't consider ourselves primarily mobile gamers. I know for certain that myself and Tim and Megan all play most of our games on either PC or console. Mm. But yeah, mobile games are a huge, huge, huge market. It's probably I'd say fastest growing market of games in the last few years. At the moment, I think there was a survey given out in around about 2012, and that's before even, you know, you got to account for some growth since then, and that was showing profits of over $7.8 billion for mobile games. And interestingly enough, over 96% of the games that were taken in that survey were found to be free-to-play or freemium, either ad-supported or using this freemium model, which we'll talk about today. So, they're obviously a very different world to console and PC games where you do actually just pay for the product up
front.
That's
crazy. It's sort of just flipped the whole distribution model on its head, really.
Mm. Yeah, so... essentially, like, to give you guys a little bit of a history of mobile gaming, like, it did actually start out that it echoed, like, mobile gaming echoed the regular distribution that we all know and love. You've got PC games and console games that you pay, you know, a premium price for. And mobile gaming did start out the same way. You had, you know, a dollar amount that you paid. Usually, I think it was probably when it started, probably between $5 and $10. But essentially, it just began this huge race to the bottom price war, ending up at around about 99 cents before this whole freemium thing kicked off. And then, yeah, it eventually went to free and just supported either by ads or using these techniques. So I know, Tim, you've had experience in explaining the Skinnerbox, which is a very commonly used game, or not game mechanic, but certainly psychological tactic.
In mobile games, it almost has become the game mechanic, which is
the scary thing.
The Skinnerbox is a very loose sort of umbrella definition for a large number of different psychological experiments that was developed by B.F. Skinner. The idea is that it was to do with operant conditioning, the idea that you could introduce variables into some creature's environment and get an expected outcome. And if you couldn't get that outcome, you could then introduce more things to the environment to, I guess, coerce that outcome.
So we're talking about the electrified grid here in the box, in the titular box.
But also food as reward was used.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
But sorry, I went the evil path there.
It's the denial of food is the other half of food as a reward. I mean, if you're hungry, you'll do whatever you're told to get the food. Regular things. I mean, rats are the easiest ones because that's what a lot of testing is done on. They've got a fair amount of intelligence, but not too much, so he still gets through ethics committees. They're cheap to produce, and no one says a lot about them if you mistreat them. So... essentially, the idea was that you would put a rat in a cage. you've jinxed me now because all I can think of is Smashing Pumpkins. They would put the rat in the box and then they would either give it some food or apply an electric current to its brain or all sorts of different wonderful and awful things to figure out what they could coerce the rat to do in different conditions.
But it's repeating that thing over and over again. Like, they come to expect it.
Well, see,
so
yeah,
when they do this particular thing, they get the reward. And you withhold it and they start jonesing for it, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. And so the idea was that you can take these psychological tools on a simple rat, but you can also apply them to a human. And we've seen through, 100 years of capitalism that that's absolutely correct. Marketing and advertising relies on some of these tactics.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And when you're looking at learning psychology as an educator, you learn it's like they all fall, Skinner and Pavlov, these sorts of researchers fall under the banner of behaviorism, if you want to look up more. Mm. And I mean, contemporary education has sort of moved on from that view. It's a bit simplified for people, but they still learned a lot.
Mm. And dopamine is a hell of a drug.
humans
will do a lot if it means getting that dopamine hit. So if you've ever found yourself on the 45th page of Reddit, at about 11:30 p.m. at night, just searching for that next hit meme, that's probably as a result of you just wanting something new and wanting to feel rewarded for the effort that you've put in to get to that deep, dark stage in your life.
Just wanting to feel alive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's usually a search for dopamine. And games are a really, really good, incentivizer for people that are looking to get that motivation and that feeling of being rewarded, because games offer these, audio prompts, they offer these graphical prompts. Like if you've ever opened a chest in Overwatch, say, for example, they have absolutely nailed the feeling, like the haptic feeling of getting rewarded for opening what is essentially just a virtual good. It doesn't exist in any way, shape or form in the real world, but you get this bright explosion of colors coming out. You get this really intense screen shake and all these things fly out and make a kind of a audible thunk of authority as they hit the ground, and you unlock all these new and interesting things that you can use in the game. And mobile games are really, really good at doing that. The really, really cool, or I guess cool and slightly evil thing that has happened over time, though, is that mobile, everyone has a mobile phone, right? And not everyone really cares too much about who has their data of how they use this software. I mean, I know probably every single one of us has been guilty of when you go to Google Play or the App Store and you go install this program, and it comes up with a list of probably two or three screens worth of all the access that you're giving this this piece of software, and you're just like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know I've done that. And but the thing is that these game developers actually get access to all that data. So they know exactly when you open your game, how long you spend in it, at what point you get bored and turn off, at what point you use it more, when, you know, what stimuli is working. And they can do these things like A-B studies. I don't know if, I mean, Megan, you'd probably know a lot more about A-B studies than I do about, you know, giving two options to two different types of populations and seeing what the difference is and then going with one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's kind of like, just like you said, like you, with one group you set condition A, maybe it's the treasure chests make super sparkly effects, and with group B they don't, or maybe that you don't get treasure chests, you just you earn the things another really boring way or a different way to see which one's more exciting, that sort of thing. And then you can pair the stats from each group and see which one's better, to see which way you want to go forward. Because they also do it with, I know this isn't really games, but you know the email marketing messages you get when you sign up, subscribe to things. They do A-B testing with them as well to see which one was more effective at getting people to buy their products or click on the links to go to the website to buy the products. Yep.
Ah, is that why MailChimp is such a big thing?
Uh-huh.
They must and give you the option to do that.
Yep, they do. And you get all the data, same as the mobile games. You get all the data, what people clicked, what, like how many people clicked what. What account is the most active at, like, opening the email newsletter and clicking on links? Wow. And I guess with the shop, if you're selling something, you can see, like, which accounts have clicked through and actually bought something, or whether they just clicked through and looked at the website but didn't buy anything. So they're all about, I guess they're using psychology to try and get you to buy things as well. So, yeah, not just games, but everyone seems to be paying more attention to the psychology and doing proper science experiments to figure out ways to make money.
Yeah, because I'd always wondered why MailChimp was such a huge thing when it's just sending out email. Yeah. But obviously, they've given you a lot of tools to be able to figure out all this kind of stuff. I guess that granularity. And it sounds really broad strokes, but, you know, that kind of example of, oh, you either get treasure chests or you don't. I mean, you can do A-B testing on anything. Like, you can do A-B testing of, you open the treasure chest and you get red sparkles versus you open the treasure chest and you get green sparkles, which makes people play for longer. Like, and it's probably a little bit pseudoscience-y. I mean, you can't account for all the variables in players' behaviors, but you can certainly try and get an idea of it. And that has been happening with more regularity, as Megan has said. You know, game developers and mobile game makers are feeling way more empowered to try and get researchers on board, because when you take that $7.8 billion worth of profit and, you know, your really massive game has like a million players, if you can get even a small percentage of those million players to pay an extra dollar each, that's making bank, you know. And yeah, you are making these tiny differences start to actually matter when you multiply them across such a massive player base. So yeah, it's you can see why big data in this case is actually starting to really be important. Now I know, Megan, you're a fan of Freakonomics. Yes. can you explain what Freakonomics kind of tries to accomplish, I guess, with their podcast?
So initially read the book, but now also listen to the podcast. It's two economists, both by the name of Stephen, and they basically look at real life examples of random things and apply their economist viewpoint to it and look at the money side of things and how it's working and really drill down into it. And it's actually quite interesting. I think the latest one I listened to, which this chat is reminding me of, is the one about Uber. So they got all the data, or they worked with Uber to make a paper, and they looked at all this data that Uber had been collecting about passengers, you know, and their rides. And I can't remember what they ended up.
Oh, what was that the thing about? They found that they had been collecting information about like police officers that were trying to take down Uber in the cities where they're not allowed. That's probably different. They probably didn't sponsor that paper.
No, but they just suddenly had this untapped, I guess, huge bank of data that no one had really had prior to Uber, because taxi companies never really used apps like Uber to track their rides and to collect all this information. So they, that's right, they're looking at demand curves and demand pricing. But prior to Uber, there was no way to collect that information. So now that everyone has this mobile, which has GPS, and it, you know, it can just record everything. And like you said, you've given the app permission to send that information back to the company who made the app. So it's not like they're spying on your phone calls or text messages. It's more like they could track as soon as you open the app whether you checked the price and booked a ride, or whether you checked the price and went, oh, no, that's not too expensive, I'm not going to buy that ride. Yeah. Or I'm going to wait 10 minutes and try again, you know, the surge pricing and all that. And now games are doing the same thing. They can see, like you said, when you've opened something, when you've bought something, when you've closed it, how long you played for.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, does that make you feel icky? Like, are you bothered by that?
I guess not really, but I come from I know that I'm not the normal person in this respect at all.
Oh, we know that.
I understand data on a level that I guess, you know, most of the population doesn't, because I work with it, and, you know, you and Megan also have worked with large volumes of data like this in the past. So it was a case, it's a case of, I know what data is out there of me and I know roughly where it is, and I know what people can do with it. And it's kind of like, either you shut yourself off from the internet and all technology forever, or you learn to accept it and either, one, mitigate what you put out there, or two, make sure that you understand where other companies and people might be coming from when they approach you. So when you every time you see an advert on the internet, that ad is there for you. It's not there. It's not the same ad that everyone else is seeing. Every single ad is there for you. And that information has come from things like what you've purchased on Google Play and what you've clicked on Facebook. In fact, I actually did an experiment recently where there's a piece of code that's it's open source. It's out there on the internet. You can grab it, you can edit it and tweak it. And what it does is it actually watches you use Facebook. So this is the exact same metric and algorithm that Facebook itself uses. In fact, Facebook can use a lot more advanced stuff than what this code can do. So it's installed as a Chrome plugin, and it watches you use Facebook. It looks at how long you hover over an article. It looks at what you click on, what you type in messages to people, because Facebook measures that. It measures where your cursor is on the page and how quickly it moves. It measures all these things, and then what it does is it throws it through a neural network, which is how big data is done these days. And it then outputs, based on your data, it tries to guess who you are, essentially. It's like, you know, you're a 28 to 36-year-old male. In fact, I think it said 28 to 31. Like, it was disturbingly accurate. It knows which political party I'm most likely to vote for, and it was correct. It knows, you know, an insane number of things about me. It even knows, like, for example, it can put a number on how likely I am to spontaneously buy something.
I thought you were going to say spontaneously combust for a minute.
You know what? It knows that as well. You can probably do that too.
Yeah.
If you know that data's out there and you understand it and you sort of make peace with it, essentially, it just means that you can, you know, view the world in that slightly skeptical lens that almost, it's not quite, I guess it's a little bit jaded. You just got to know.
Yeah. It is a brand new world of using this big data. And I guess what we wanted to highlight with regards to talking about all this is that there has been research that has shown that this new world of big data and applying you know, techniques to analyze people's behavior and all that kind of stuff has shown that traditional marketing techniques may not work in the new digital age. And a quick shout out to Andy, who sent us this paper, I don't know how long ago. It must have been close to 6 months ago, and at we are least. Finally getting around to talking about it on a different podcast. So thank you, Andy, for sending this in. It was a really fascinating paper, and we wanted to give it its due. But yeah, so this was a paper that combined Stephen Levitt from previously mentioned Freakonomics and King.com, a mobile games developer who has made some really big games in the past. They've made games like Candy Crush Saga, Clash of Clans, and now their new one, which is another Clan Wars or something like that, which people play a lot of. And essentially, this paper showed that digital selling and digital goods just don't quite follow the same rules as a normal piece of good or service. Because, you know, say if I offered you, Megan, if I said, well, this thing that you're using every day, so say, I don't know, you're a parent, so nappies, you get a you get a 70% discount on nappies, would you buy more nappies? Would you buy yes. less nappies? Yeah, I'd, exactly.
I'd stock up.
Exactly. Because it's a good that you are going to use eventually, because you know you use it every day. What they found in this paper, which is titled, let me just have a quick look, Quantity Discounts on a Virtual Good, the Results of a Massive Pricing Experiment at King Digital Entertainment. It's by authors Stephen D. Levitt, John A. List, Suzanne Neckerman, and David Nelson, in collaboration, obviously, with King Digital. So they analyzed 14 million customer data sets. This is what we're talking about when we talk about big data. So that's 14 million players. That's a... Man, as a scientist, like, thinking about that kind of data is good. It's a really nice feeling. I don't know about you guys, but
large sample size.
Yeah, large sample sizes are a-okay with us. So they analyzed 14 million customer data sets, and to give you kind of a bit of background on the game, so I believe that this was done on Candy Crush Saga. I'm not actually 100% on this, but I think that's what it was on, but they're a very smart developer, and they've actually built the game from the ground up to be able to offer different discounts to different players. So every single thing in their game with regards to premium currency, and premium currency in these freemium, what they call freemium games, is essentially currency that allows you to skip some of the, I guess, annoying barriers that are in games. So quite often games will have, like, games that are freemium games will be like, you make a move, you know, once per day, and that's it, unless you buy some premium currency, and then you can spend that premium currency to make another move per day.
I think with Candy Crush, it was like you have 5 lives or something, and right. every time you fail a level, you lose a life, and then you had to wait 30 minutes or an hour for each life to regenerate. And you can fail a level really quickly because some of the levels are almost impossible to solve or to win. Because they're just randomly generated.
Oh, right. So the difficulty was kind of randomly, massively spiked, and you just couldn't do anything about it.
And it was also the fact that, I mean, this is true with most of these styles of games, is that because it's randomly generated, it's not that you might sometimes get a difficult one. It's that you might sometimes get an easy one.
Yeah.
Most of them are difficult to the point of being almost impossible.
It becomes less reliant on skill. And because it's less reliant on skill, you're going to burn through those lives quickly, no matter what kind of player you are.
Right, yeah. But by that stage, you're already so hooked into the Skinner box of wanting to get that reward at the end of the level.
Get to the next level and,
yeah.
And that if you actually do. This starts to sound a bit like how a Pokemon machine operates. You would be absolutely correct.
You'd be absolutely
because
correct.
Because that is exactly how a Pokemon machine operates.
Yeah, Pokemon machines are probably the predecessor to these kinds of games, absolutely.
I guess also, you haven't talked about it yet, but at the start of these sorts of games, the first few levels are actually quite easy and you zip through them without using any of your lives, that sort of thing. And it's and that gets you hooked in, and then it starts getting difficult, and then you sort of go, oh, I kind of need that digital currency to, you know, buy another life and that sort of thing.
Those earlier levels are usually the ones where, you know, you do one level and you could basically breathe on the screen and you'll pass the first level. And at the end of the level, like, you get fanfare and treasure chests are opening everywhere and, you know, getting all these rare cards or rare items that are, you know, going to help you for the rest of your thing. And you don't know at the time that those items or cards or whatever are going to be completely useless in about five levels, but you've forgotten by that stage anyway, because you've gotten more stuff, which is even more rare and all this kind of stuff. So it is a very nefarious kind of way of getting people hooked into a game. But yeah, so King.com and or I should say King Digital, it's not King.com anymore, but King Digital did this. They had built this game from the ground up to be able to do these kind of experiments, to do A/B testing, to offer different players different, you know, discounts and all that kind of stuff. So you've got a very fertile ground to perform these kind of natural experiments. And essentially what they did was they offered a discount of different kind of depth to different portions of the player base. So for 4 million people, remember, this is a huge data set. So for 4 million people, they offered the standard discount. Like, it's just a standard 9% discount. For 6 million people, they offered a 23% discount. For another 6 million people, they offered a 55% discount. This is all on the premium currency. And for a lucky 4 million people, they offered a 73% discount on this premium currency. Now, if we're a standard economist and we're working in the standard market of, say, nappies, on a good that you are using every day, you would expect that as that discount goes up, people start buying more of it. That absolutely did not happen in this case. And this is why we're trying to say that this new frontier of digital goods is just not, it doesn't behave the same way as a standard good.
Yeah.
Essentially, they saw zero change. It was so close to zero that they called it negligible. That they didn't. No one in any of those categories, from the 9% to the 73%, changed their buying habits at all. It stayed. If you look at the, I think it's table one in the paper, and obviously we will link to the paper in our. It's on PNAS, so it's able to be accessed in full by anybody. You can see table one, it actually shows like practically none of the numbers change. And that's very surprising, even to me and us, I guess, that even like digital goods are so kind of a part of our gaming life now that you would expect that if you offered a discount, people would want to buy it. But it's just not the case in these premium things. I'm not 100% sure why that is. I mean, do you guys have any theories about that?
I don't know why, but my guess would be that most of the people playing these sorts of games are casual gamers, I guess, most. I'm not saying all. So to them, it's just a quick pastime, you know, a fun thing to do. They don't see it as a serious thing. They're like, oh, I'm just playing a game. And to invest in something like premium currency, which you can't, it's a virtual thing. You can't even see it or feel it. You're not holding it. You're not going to get it from the shop. I guess if they place less value or no value on it whatsoever, they would just rather go, oh, I'll have to put the game down for a few hours and wait till my lives regenerate and then pick it up again then. I think it's placing no value on the currency. So even if it's discounted, they're still like, I don't want to waste my money on this game. And, you know, seeing the game as not a negative thing, but a really low value, I don't care, but, you know, I can live without it thing, so why would I pay money for it? If it's because now it's this culture of, you know, I expect to get good games, mobile games for free.
Which is insane. Like you're saying. Because as a developer, like, I would like to get paid for work that I do.
But the people, like I said, there's sorts of casual gamers who are playing these games and expecting to get them for free wouldn't necessarily have a console or play on the PC or be used to paying money for games in general anyway. Yeah. So they don't value that. Like, they would rather spend their money on whatever other hobbies or interests they have, or, you know.
I mean, I shouldn't, but I feel like that kind of monetary system is lazy on the part of the developers. It's smart and it gets you lots of money, but I feel like it's a lazy tactic because, sure, you're only going to get a portion of the population who spend money on the game, and the portion that don't will just play it for free and then will never play it again. But I feel like you know, if you wanted to make some money out of the game, a small entry price for a good game is a much more moral way to go about it.
Well, I actually have bought a lot more games in the last year, I think, since attending PAX a bit more and going to the indie arcade area and meeting the developers more. I often buy those games almost straight away when I get home.
Yeah, me too.
But the $5 to $10 mark, I'm quite happy to pay that amount because I know I'm going to get a good quality game that'll last me quite a lot longer than the freemium games. Because when I get to that point in the freemium game, after the initial, here's how to play, here's lots of rewards, oh, okay, now you still have to wait an hour to play again, I sort of get bored really quick, or I get fed up of ads, and I will not play those games for as long.
Ads are the big ones for me.
Yeah, they really turn me off. And when I see the freemium model, when I see it sort of sneaking, and I'm like, oh, okay, I see where this is going. And I don't like buying premium currency, but like I said, I'm happy to spend $5 to $10 on a really good mobile game that'll last me a lot longer. So I'd rather do that.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other couple of really interesting things that came out of this was, like, I understand, like, your argument that people that didn't buy it before wouldn't buy it then, kind of thing. Like, that makes sense. People that haven't bought premium currency aren't going to change their mind. They're usually the people that are way casual and all that kind of stuff. But the interesting thing was that when they offered these deep discounts to, you know, your whales, which are basically the people that spend thousands or hundreds or thousands of dollars on these games, they also made less money on these people because they were offering such a discount that it actually, that ruined their, you know, expected value back from these people. So by offering, like, they didn't get their main incentive to offer this discount was to get those people that weren't spending any money. And instead, they actually sabotaged their profits from the people that were spending the money, because the people that were spending the money are going to spend it anyway. Yeah. It doesn't matter if you offer them a discount. They're so addicted and so deep into these games that they're just going to buy them anyway. But the people that, you're actually sabotaging your own profits. Really, really interesting and a really interesting phenomenon to come out of this study and the psychology, that bizarre psychology that we're facing with these kind of freemium games.
Yeah, I guess they see it as free, so they expect it to be free. They don't expect to have to pay for a premium currency.
So they're
going to keep rorting the system in any way that possible to keep it being free. I read about, and I tried it, and it worked for me, where you change the clock and the date on your phone.
Oh, wow.
You can regenerate your lives and then change the clock and the date back, and you still have those lives in some of the games. Not all of them, but yeah.
Yeah, I imagine some of them would be, you know, smart to that. But yeah, wow, that's sneaky. I've never tried that. But that's the thing, like, the fact that you even did that shows how strongly these games can make you want to play them. Like, oh, I would never, you would never think, oh, like, I'd better change my, like, it is actually an active thing that you had to do to be able to get these lives back.
Clock hacks in a lot of games.
Yeah, but it just shows how addictive these games can be. And I think the combination of big data and this kind of psychology will show us some really, really interesting things, as long as companies like King Digital keep kind of opening up the archives to be able to do these really interesting studies. So, yeah.
I liked your game that you brought up previously, See Hero Quest, how they were using the big data to basically do their Alzheimer's research from their game, which was an app. That was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is that the cost of doing this per data set is nothing.
Yeah.
It's they had a line in the paper that said the cost per subject of running this experiment was perhaps 1/100 of 1 cent. So you're paying absolutely nothing per subject.
1 millicent.
Yeah, exactly. It's insane. So yeah, it certainly does offer up a lot of a lot of incentive for researchers to kind of get in contact with these companies and say, look, you know, if you're selling one product to 160 million people or whatever, or 14 million people, if you make even the tiniest change, you're going to earn big profits. So I think this is definitely a burgeoning research area for sure. Okay, we will wrap it up there. As usual, you can find all the papers and stuff that we've mentioned on this program on the website. And we'll also try and put up a couple of more papers and maybe some infographics for people to use about the psychology of mobile gaming. We have found a couple of those in our searches. So thank you very much for listening. You can find us on the web at pressx2.science and on Facebook as facebook.com/pressx2science. We would really appreciate it if you could share the podcast through social media or word of mouth, and rate us up on iTunes with 5 stars if you enjoyed the show. Also, feel free to send us in any questions, comments, or feedback to questions@pressx2.science. From the three of us here, we'll talk to you soon.